I'd like to get started. We've got lots and lots of ground to cover, members, so we are covering today the Minnesota Department of Human Services budget. To lay the groundwork for committee members, it's my intention that we use today as an understanding, not a debate. We'll have plenty of time when the bills come forward and we have the details of language and so forth. So questions that are about clarification and understanding are certainly welcomed, but I will cut off if it starts to be what I think sort of debate or whatever kinds of things. I think we'll have plenty of chance for that. Now, just to put some frame on it, I can't really determine, even with that ground rule, how much time the committee may need to understand. It's our intention and hope that we might be able to finish it today. That would be my primary hope. If we're not able to finish it, we'll carry over into tomorrow. However, we have three bills scheduled, and I think out of deference to people who may be here, we'll hear those three bills first. I think we should be able to complete those three bills in an hour or so, so we would have some additional time tomorrow at our regularly scheduled meeting. And then if we're still not done yet, then the plan would be to continue it into the evening at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Now, it'll be up to us whether or not we need to do that, but I wanted to at least have contingency plans in case we need to do that. So, with that, let's call forth Commissioner Goodnow, and we'll begin the presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Kevin Goodnow, Commissioner of Human Services for the state of Minnesota. My intent today is to give you a broad, for me to give you a broad overview of our budget and where we're at, more of a global perspective, have Jane Hardwick come forward and then kind of orient you to the budget document that you have in front of you, and then have the assistant commissioners come forward and go into more detail about the specific proposals that we have. The Department of Human Services budget was projected to increase from the previous biennium by about 18%. That's looking at both health care access fund spending and also general fund spending. If you roll out the health care access fund spending, it's closer to 20% level. The under the proposal that we have in front of that you have in front of you today, that spending increase will go from the 18% to 15% projected increase over the previous biennium. And to put that in perspective, the biennium before, we had, with even reducing our projected spending growth by $1 billion, we had about a 10 to 12% increase in our budget from the previous biennium. So the Department of Human Services is increasing spending, even under this budget, to the tune of about $1.1 billion. Now, even with that, when you look at reducing eligibility, the spending increase or the projected spending increase, we do need to make some changes to current policies, and it will impact people, impact programs that we have. When we put our budget together, our main goal was to contain the spending growth in our area. In other words, contain the size of the pie that we currently have in this biennium. Also invest in cost containment initiatives and infrastructure initiatives related to looking at how we can control escalating healthcare costs in the future, so get a handle on the inflationary factor that's there. And then also make sure and target investments in key priority areas. And the key priority areas that we looked at were investing in children. We have a number of initiatives related to children, some of the most at-risk children in the state of Minnesota. An initiative related to long-term homelessness and trying to eliminate long-term homelessness in the state of Minnesota based on a governor's initiative. Moving forward with a healthcare or a system of care for the frail elderly that's quality-based as well as cost-based. Looking at, as I mentioned before, investments in our healthcare programs, investments that will help us control the cost of a growth in our programs in the future. And you will also find there's investments in our infrastructure. And we have some investments in our infrastructure. I know it's not politically sexy. It's not things that you'll see the governor putting in his campaign brochure. I doubt it that I would see any legislator here put it in their campaign brochures. But they're investments that are necessary to run the day-to-day operations of the agency. The reality is, as time has gone on and over the years, even as we've been reducing the spending increases in our budget, our enrollments in our programs are increasing. The number of providers we're dealing with is increasing. The number of people that we come in contact with in a year's time is increasing. And so that does put pressure on our system, and we'll identify those infrastructure and those administrative investments that we think we need in order to continue to operate a well-administered programs in the state of Minnesota. With that, that's my general overview. I told you it would be brief. I'd like to have Jane Hardwick come forward and walk you through the budget document just so you get an orientation through that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Wilcox Hardwick, I'm the budget director for the agency, and I have the esteemed duty here of walking you, orienting you through the book. The document that you have before you is essentially in three different sections. The first section of the book contains the governor's recommended changes to the human services budget. It starts with the first document, which is a cover letter from Commissioner Goodnow, essentially consistent with much of the information he just provided in terms of investments and decision-making in terms of where we made recommendations for reductions. The next part of that document includes agency overview. It's a summary fiscal information where everything sort of rolls up into one document, and there are two pages that contain that. And then the next page behind that, page four, contains what's called the change summary, which summarizes the fiscal information from each of the change item pages. And so that's there for your summary reference. The next part of the document, again, some light yellow pages, is actually a narrative of each of the fiscal change items, and it includes summary fiscal information at the top of the page, a succinct description of the recommended change, and then more background and more detail around the change itself, including, in many cases, some information about how it compares to the base budget and information on key measures associated with that particular change. The next section I would direct you to is right behind the light yellow pages. There's a more of a bright yellow document. Because the Department of Finance format doesn't allow us to include some of the fiscal detail that's present on this particular document, we call this our detailed tracking. I might recommend that you actually pull this out of your book and set it to the side. As we go through the change items, you'll be able to see the fiscal detail for reference, which will help you to better understand what the moving pieces are in the specific proposals. And on the left side of that page, as you go through each change item, it references the page in the earlier part of the document that you will find the more complete recommendation on. The next section, section two, entitled Background, you'll see that when you get to the next coral-colored page. This contains the agency's budget background, including agency overview, program overviews, budget activity narratives, and the base budget fiscal information, as well as the effect of the change items on the agency's base budget. So that's all there for your reference. And this material is also available on the Department of Finance website. If you have folks asking you for more detail or reference, it's also there for your reference.
Could you give us the website address for that Department of Finance? Can I have that?
We will get that to the committee, Mr. Chair. I don't have it handy here. The next section, again, separated by a coral-colored page, section 3 is the appendix to the document. Some of this material is available on the Department of Finance website. The majority of it is not. This is essentially supplemental information to assist you in understanding the agency and the program recommendations. It includes an organizational chart, some information on our biennial budget structure, including what the various budget activities are and how they fit into our organization. Agency-wide budget charts by program, by fund, by category, by administration, and then two charts regarding FTEs from 1995 through fiscal year 2005, both in the central office and then in state-operated services. It includes some other reference documents, including the federal poverty guidelines as they relate to various household sizes, which is often useful as we typically reference a level of poverty in many of our income standards, and it's helpful to see what that means in terms of actual dollars for families. The supplemental security income guidelines, some program summary information and detail on the health care programs, which in an area where we are recommending some changes this time, I think that background information would be helpful for you to understand what the base program looks like. Some information on the Medicaid waivers that we have. We have both 1115 demonstration waivers from the federal government and 1915C waivers, which are home and community-based waivers. And there's a summary of what those are for your reference as well.
We have a cost of living adjustment history for providers that serve in the medical assistance program to give you a sense of what their payment adjustments have been over an extended period of time. Information on our federal TANF fund balance within the state. And two last documents. One is a summary of abbreviations and acronyms. We try not to use them at the table, but occasionally slip into those, and that information is there for your reference, as well as something we refer to as the grant detail table, which is the last document there, and that identifies all of our non-forecasted programs and the funding sources for each of those, including actual spending in 04, projected 05, and then 06, 07 budget recommendations in those areas. It includes things that are not typically dealt with in the direct appropriation budget, includes statutory appropriations, federal resources, and other sources of funding for those particular grants, as well as the description of those grants that you won't find in that level of detail anywhere else. Are there any questions on the document itself or any other orientation that might be helpful to the committee?
There have been some publication recently about sort of off-chart expenditures. And that would be other than our general fund or healthcare access fund or the kind of the typical things. In your document, do you have anything that would speak to or at least itemize some of those things that might be in the Department of Human Services?
I think those are typically, that term is typically used often in reference to special revenue funds, and that is not contained in this document, but I would be happy to provide that to the committee.
Yes, and I would like to get that for us and for the committee.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Goodwin.
Also, the budget document doesn't contain a line on professional technical contracts. I got that information from a conversation I had with Linda Boudreau, but the information doesn't include all the contracts that I got, and there are, according to the Department of Finance, $77 million worth of contracts at the Department of Human Services, and the list that I got only has $34 million, so that's less than half, about half, and also it doesn't say what these contracts are for, and the list I got from the other departments does say what the contracts are for, so I would appreciate a more detailed list, and probably every member of this committee should have that list as well.
Madam Chair, I was just over in the Senate, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin.
Commissioner. I could be mean, but I won't.
So much for our budget, right? Assistant Commissioner Denny Erickson is here, and he can respond to Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Erickson. Mr. Chairman, and for the record, Dennis Erickson, Assistant Commissioner at DHS, and Representative Goodwin, the budget document does not contain the list of all of the contracts. The Department of Finance, as I understand, prepared that as a separate report, and I believe that's the report that was shared with you from the Deputy Commissioner. The increase in costs for our contracts that are on that report, the $76 million you referred to, I'd be happy to speak to. The $34 million on the list that you're referring to is a one-year list. Those are all of the current contracts, the current open contracts right now, and that was in response to your request for what's the list of all of the current contracts that the department has. And so what you have that you're referring to is a list of all of the current contracts that are currently open in the department. They total, I believe, somewhere around $34 million. The numbers on the report here, the 77-76, is a biennial figure. It's a two-year figure. And, of course, the contracts go up and down during the year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the Department of Finance has projected $72.6 million for contracts for 06-07. And so you see you have $34 million that are currently active. And $77 million that you spent last time, I'm just saying that doesn't add up. And also, I have the statute here that 16A.11 subdivision 3C, and it says the detailed estimates must include a separate line listing the total cost of professional and technical service contracts for the prior biennium and the projected cost of those contracts for the current and upcoming biennium. They must also include summary of the personnel employed by agency reflect as full-time equivalents. Well, I know you got the full-time equivalents in there, but the agencies have not complied with this law that has been in effect since 1998.
If I may, Representative Goodwin, I know you've had this as an ongoing, and I'm not really in a good position to make judgment, but I think this is an issue that we need to take offline from today's, or we'll spend more time on it. I know you've raised this on other budgets as well. I tried myself to sort of research the differences of opinion about the language, but we're not going to be able to settle that here.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple notes. So that if you're looking at our current contracts and they add up to $34 million, contracts aren't necessarily signed for the duration of the biennium. They are annual contracts, so they have limited time periods. So it doesn't necessarily mean they don't add up when our current contracts only total $34 million, but we're projecting that we'll spend on contracts in the range of $70 million for the biennium, because that's a two-year period, and we're just talking about contracts on this list that we're currently engaged in. If you look at, and there was a comment made that we don't have the purpose for what the contracts are, if you look under the listing, there's something called the object code, and the object code is related to, and we'll get the information to, but we do have the listing of what they're for. And the object code is related to a chart, and that object code is what the contracts are spent on, but a large percentage of our contracts are related to state-operated services and contracting with healthcare professionals provide professional services to individuals.
And Commissioner and Assistant Commissioner Erickson, I think the question being raised, it certainly is fair to the members of our committee, if we could get a copy of what Representative Goodwin has so we could share that with the remainder of the committee, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Representative Goodwin.
One final question. Yes, but the other agencies gave me information about what the contract was for, not the contract code. None of us here understand that. So could you please give us that information, this information with the contract description on it, and also what the $77 million was spent on in the last two, in this current biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, the code has general categories: printing, general management and fiscal services, advertising, writing, program evaluation, architect and engineering, et cetera, et cetera. If you want more detail than that, we have about a thousand contracts. That's very time consuming from our perspective, and we can do it. I'm not going to guarantee that we can turn around in a quick manner, because there are other priorities that we're dealing with. Needless in dealing with the legislature and the budget that we have before you, but also other priorities in managing the programs that we have. So we will provide that information if that's what you want, that level of detail, but we can't necessarily guarantee that it will be done in a very short period of time.
Commissioner, from my own point of view, I would take what you have, and because I've not had a chance to review that myself, I think Representative Goodwin has the right to ask you whether or not you can produce. I'm not going to ask for that detail at a committee level. So you'll have to work it out between Representative Goodwin and yourselves.
Madam Chair and Representative Goodwin, we'll follow up with you and find out what level, because depending upon the level, it can be less or more time consuming in doing that. And we want to get you the information that you need to make your decisions, but we can work on that outside of this committee process.
Commissioner Goodwin, you call me Madam Chair once more, and we're going to... Representative Goodwin.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but I just have to say, because in 16C, you're required to produce that information for the Legislative Reference Library so we all have access to it. So I'm concerned that it's so difficult for you to provide that information when you could just keep an ongoing list. It's only a line that describes what the contract is actually for. And I've got the ones from DNR and every other agency that I've requested so far. MnDOT has more contracts than you do. They can produce that list. And so I would say you maybe need to change your finance practices so that you can put them all in as they go in, and that you can produce that list for us. That's an important, and it's a lot of money.
Let's proceed.
Mr. Chairman, then, if the committee is ready and you're ready, I'll start walking through the budget documents.
Yes, please.
Okay. In the finance and management area of the department, there are three change requests. Those begin on page 7, the yellow pages, page 7. the first request that you see in front of you is a request that is newer than one that you haven't seen in the past, because it was a base level adjustment in the past. And I believe a couple of years ago the legislature requested that base level adjustments having to do with leases and rent be showed as a change request, so you could see the amount of money that is moving for rents and leases. This amount of money is the increased lease rental cost to the Department of Human Services for the coming biennium. It represents a bigger increase than we have seen in the past. That's because it is associated with the new Elmer Anderson Human Services building that the department will be occupying later this year. That building has, in addition to the lease costs or the rental costs that we pay, in the detail of the arrangement, the ability for the state to purchase that building for a dollar at the end of the 20-year lease period. And so essentially the lease costs have an equity buildup in there as well as the normal rental costs. And so that's pretty much the story behind these numbers here. Please proceed. Next page is a request for a number of items, three major requests on this page. This is in the licensing area of the department. The first request is for 15 additional staff, which I'll detail in just a second. The second is to increase fees for background study costs to cover the costs of those background studies. In other words, this is the assessment of the amount necessary to just cover the work that's done associated with those background studies. And the third is a restructuring of the licensing fees for home and community-based service providers. As an explanation, beginning from last to first, the restructuring fees for home and community-based service providers takes what is currently a $400 flat fee for those providers and changes it to a $250 flat fee plus $38 per client. What that means is the smaller facilities actually have a decrease in their fees, and of course as you go past into the larger facilities, the fees go up. The net effect is an increase overall in revenues generated by that particular proposal. The second one I pretty much explained, which is just the increase in fees for background studies to $20 per background study to cover all of the associated costs in doing background studies. The first request is a request for 15 staff. There are three components to that request. The first is a request for six new investigators in order to handle the increased current caseload of investigations of child and adult maltreatment. This would take and bring back the numbers from 50 cases per year per investigator to our target of 36, or about three per month. In the second area, there is an increase for licensing staff of six. These are the program licensors within the licensing area. This would lower their current caseload on a yearly basis from 220 to 162 facilities to be licensed per year. The third request is for one additional person to handle the increased due process requirements that are called for under the administrative reconsideration process, which has been getting more and more complicated for us as we disqualify people for through background studies. These individuals have the ability to appeal that disqualification in a process that we call reconsideration, and we are behind on the reconsideration request. This due process requirement is one that has been put on us by the court system, and one with which we need to comply. So that's the overall request on this page. For those staff, just to answer kind of the basic question on staffing, what have we done with staffing in this area in the past? Staffing in the licensing and maltreatment area has been essentially flat for about the last 10 years or so. I believe the numbers are up from about 48 to 51 in that combined area. Over that time, we've done a number of things to deal with the increased workload. One was to separate and specialize licensing staff into program licensors and investigators and that. We've reorganized the operations within the licensing division. And finally, we proposed to the legislature, and you have enacted a change in how often we license. We went from 1 year to 2 year licenses, and then with certain targeted licensing. So we haven't been licensing as often. So those are some of the remedies that have been used in the past based on that workload. At this point, we're at the point where increased staff seems to be the only option.
Commissioner Erickson, are the expenses then entirely covered by the licensing? This is a zero balance kind of thing?
Mr. Chairman, not all of the licensing fees for the whole division are recovered. In the background study area, that is correct. In the other areas, it's been a increased fees to cover most of the operations, but it's never been quite a full equal dollar-for-dollar situation.
And Mr. Erickson, if there is a shortfall, does that mean it's a general fund that makes up the difference then?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Thank you.
Moving on to the...
Excuse me, Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. Just a brief one on that. On the background checks, what's the difference between a direct cost per background study and the indirect costs?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, indirect costs are an accounting situation that we deal with through the Department of Finance, where all the different programs in state government that have revenues that come into them are assessed an indirect cost. That indirect cost goes to the general fund to cover general government indirect costs.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, then I would move on to the next page, which would be page 11. Page 11 is also a request for increased staff. This is an area for administrative fair hearings. The Department of Human Services conducts fair hearings. Might be more familiar to the committee as administrative law judges that conduct hearings through OAH. In DHS, we call them referees. This is a process that has been self-contained within the department for many years since it was required by the federal government. The referees hear a number of cases having to do with any adjustments to services and that clients receive and have the ability to appeal adverse decisions. The caseloads in this area have been going up dramatically in the last couple of years. They've gone up somewhere between 40% and 60%. 2 years ago, the legislature gave us two additional staff here, but they were time limited, and they sunset at the end of this biennium. That was in recognition of not knowing whether that increased caseload was going to continue or whether it was a one-time phenomena. It has continued and has continued to increase, and so the request here for additional staff includes restoring the sunsetted staff and an additional six referees and support staff to deal with the caseload. Right now, caseloads for referees are at about 470 per year, and our target for referees are 300 per year in terms of what they can handle. That includes conducting the case, scheduling the case, sitting through the case, writing up decisions, et cetera. Any questions?
Proceed. Oops, I'm
sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the alternatives considered with the Office of Administrative Hearings, it says that the cost for them for each appeal to the OAH is $5,000. Do you know what the cost for your proceedings are? And is there a distinction between the kind of cases they hear and the cases that your referees handle?
Mr. Erickson?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, some of the cases are very similar, and some are a little more specific to our area. It's a little more formal proceeding at OAH than it is in our area, but ours are getting much more formal due to requirements, due process requirements, and others that the courts impose kind of after the fact if our cases are appealed into the court system. The difference in cost, I don't have it figured out entirely, but we would pay or $135 per hour and $74 for staff attorneys. That's what we would pay per hour for cases, as opposed to what we pay our staff right now per hour to conduct the hearing. So it would be substantially less. I could do the calculation for you and get it back to you if you'd like.
When you would get to it, that would be helpful.
Yeah, if you could share that with the committee.
And Mr. Chair, and with that, just kind of a, if there is some distinction between the complexity in the cases that are referred out to the OAH versus the ones that you do, if you could provide a little background on that too, that would be helpful.
Be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Proceed. Those are the change requests in the finance and management area, and I would.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner.
Next person, I believe, Lauren Coleman. The Children and Family Services area of our agency responsibility has been shifted to the Representative Gunther's committee, I believe, so we're not going to be going over that portion of the budget.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Coleman. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lauren Coleman, the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care. I'll be presenting two change pages this morning, starting on page 39. And on the tracking tool, it's on page 8, line 292. The governor recommends that resources that would have automatically increased some medical assistance rates for nursing facilities in fiscal year 06 be redirected so that effective October 1, 2005, all nursing facilities would receive a 2% increase over the rates in effect on June 30, 2005. This rate increase would be flexible funding to better enable the nursing facilities to transition to a new reimbursement system. The current reimbursement system doesn't meet the needs of the residents, staff, providers, or the state. It is time for a change. This has been a 10-year agenda. It is important that any new funding for nursing facilities be provided in the framework of a new reimbursement system. The governor's budget provides funding to promote quality of care, increasing rates, and improved staffing levels while helping nursing facilities to transition to this new system. As I indicated, a 2% increase over the rates in effect on June 30th would go into effect on October 1st. This rate increase will provide flexible funding to better enable nursing facilities to position themselves to succeed under the new payment system. Additionally, higher payments will be targeted to nursing facilities that are of high quality. Higher quality facilities will be rewarded by having the option to transition to the new reimbursement system sooner. Additionally, in fiscal years 08 and 09, additional funding will be targeted to increase direct care staffing levels. To further ease the transition, the new system will be phased in over 4 years. It's a major change for providers and could result in some providers receiving large rate decreases. Nursing facilities that would receive decreases will initially be protected from significant decreases in their rates, allowing time for management to change practices to better manage in the new system. The four-year phase-in will provide an opportunity to adjust as the proportion of the rate is transitioned to the new system. Without getting into too many details, the first year of the phase-in would be 10% of the new system, 90% of the old system. The second year would be 40% of the new system, 60%, and so forth. There's still work to be done. DHS and stakeholders and a development committee have been working for the past year to refine the details of the new system. While good progress has been made, there is more work to be done. We have attempted to listen to stakeholders and integrate teachers into the transition to make this system successful. I have details on the values of each transition piece if you wish to go into it detail at this time. This is a complex change, and I anticipate additional testimony will be or review will be necessary to go through the details at that time.
If I can just make sure at least that the framework is clear. First, the proposal says that the automatic increase that would go to sort of the nursing homes who are on the contract, that's removed. That's where you get some savings. But then you're putting back in place and across the board 2%. Am I right so far in that? And then in that, what proportion of our current nursing homes are under that sort of that contract relationship that would have gotten them the automatic increase?
Okay. Mr. Chair, we are suspending the APS COLA. You're correct. We are redirecting that to allow for this transition. Approximately 75% of current facilities are in the APS program, but they represent about 82% of the expenditures.
So, and Mr. Foreman, the numbers that are on our tracking sheet then are sort of the net after you withdraw the automatic and then apply the 2%. Am I reading this correctly?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Coleman, on page 39, fiscal years 2006 and fiscal years 2007, there are decreases in the net funding to nursing homes, if I read this correctly.
Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, that's a result of what Mr. Coleman had just talked about with Representative Huntley about the APS. The APS systems in our state have an automatic COLA that's related to them. Rather than giving just 75% of the facilities an increase, we've given an increase to all the facilities and tied it into the new rate system.
And Commissioner Coleman, what was that percent that those APS would have gotten? I assume it was something more than the 2%, because otherwise you wouldn't have met.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's some money.
Mr. Chair, then unless it's on another page here, the net of this is we're spending less on nursing homes in 2006 and 2007 than was previously forecast.
Forecasted, I think, would be correct.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner,
but. That's true, Mr. Chairman, and correct. Although I would say that we're spending more on certain homes that are receiving rates that wouldn't have received a rate increase. So,
I think we're fair to say biennium to biennium, there's an increase in spending for nursing homes. But what was forecast had this built in. And I'm sorry, somebody have an answer to my question was? Mr. Hill, if you'd introduce yourself.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my name is Bob Hill, Department of Services. The projected APS COLA for 06 is 1.97%, and for 07 it's 1.79%.
So it'll be pretty close to 4%, then probably net by the compounding factor. Thank you. Any further questions? And also, just to make sure that I understand something right, you said there's a lot to be done. Maybe you could just at least signal us what we may expect as these things move forward. Is there agreement? I know that there's been a lot of work with the industry and so forth on the new rate system. Can you anticipate for us what we will hear when we sort of open this up and have the detail? Is there agreement, or are we still going to hear some disagreement? Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, I can't fully anticipate what others might present to the committee, but it is our intent to try to narrow the differences as much as possible and keep within the framework of what we're trying to achieve. I would say that in general there is support for the framework. The hard work is in the details and how to make sure that people can transition effectively and have enough resources to do that.
Thank you. Representative Meekin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I was just wondering about the 75% of those that were getting the EPS COLA. Is what you're telling me is that 75% of the nursing homes out there are going to be getting less than what they would have gotten under current law?
Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they over the total phase-in, the four-year phase-in, I don't believe that that would be accurate, because we are also indicating a redirection of the APS COLA for increased staffing. But according to current law for the next 2 years, I think you would be correct in that it is an APS forecast that they would be entitled to.
Okay. Representative Deacon. Okay, thank you. So again, just to reiterate, 75% of our nursing homes up over the next, for the two-year biennium, are going to be getting a cut in funding.
They're going to get an increase in their rate. They would not get what was forecast, but there is a difference. So
right. According to current law, under current law, they're getting a cut in funding from what they would under current law. So, and as far as current law is concerned, again, as far as the net amount of funding, it's flat according to current law. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, if the amount of funding was flat, then you wouldn't be able to say that there was actually a cut under current law. So Mr. Chairman, Representative Eakin, right now, the APS systems, because they're in the APS, you know, their APS facility, are projected. They were one of the few providers that get automatic cost of living or rate adjustments over the period. The only other ones that are like that are the hospitals, which have a freeze in their rebasing under current law until 2007, and also child care providers is the only other provider group out there that have automatic increases. Rather than taking away the increase from the nursing homes, what we've done is taken the nursing the rate increase and redirected it away from 75% and applied it to 100% of facilities in an attempt to move forward with our new reimbursement system, which is quality-based, which rewards facilities for meeting certain quality standards, including staffing levels. And also, the net effect of it will be to start the right now in our current reimbursement system, we have nursing facilities that receive high rates and facilities that receive very low rates. It will start bringing that band in, so you will see an increasing of the rates, a leveling of the rates. It's still not going to be equalized, but it'll be closer to, to the mainstream, so to speak, with regard to rates. It's long overdue with regard to the reimbursement system, and this is an opportunity to move forward with that. And the reality is that 75% of facilities in this biennium will see less of a rate increase than they would have seen but for this change. But overall, I think what you will see is a better rate system for all the nursing facilities in place, which will result in better care for the nursing home patients that are out there.
Well, I think we have a pretty good understanding, committee, whether people agree or disagree, but I think we should move on.
Mr. Chair, and one of the commissioners, our fiscal person, what's the base level that we're dealing with? I mean, we're just looking at, on page 39, we're looking at the differences from the forecast. What's the base number we're talking about?
Michelle?
Members, chairs, I just looked that up. and I have only FY06-07 base numbers, so this is not, this is right from the base budget document, 516-400 for 06 and 511-542 for 07. Now, there might be some adjustments there, especially as we have a number of different recommendations being presented to us. And then if I take the 82% of expenditures that Assistant Commissioner Coleman quoted, I get about $424,000. So that would give you how much is spent on three-quarters of the facilities that get APS. Does that help?
Commissioner?
And Mr. Chairman, just to put those numbers in perspective, that's the long-term care facilities cost of medical assistance, so it does include ICFMRs, and it's a state-only cost associated with it, so there's a federal match on that. So if you look at it as a percentage of the budget, you're looking at $1 billion for the biennium for the state-only funds, so you're $1 million net savings off of projected. You can do the math.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm sorry.
Briefly.
We spent a lot of time on this. If it's understanding
it's not a question, it's a request.
Welcome.
If Ms. Schill could provide the committee with a document that showed 0405, then the base 0607, and then the change with the final.
I think that's a fair request, and I suspect, Ms. Schill, that that'll be a matter of some interest probably on all of our budgets, so we can, yes. Maybe it'll help from the department as well.
Mr. Chairman, that information is readily available. I will warn you that with regard to long-term care facilities, you will see a decline because it's a relatively flat part of our budget as people are transitioning into community-based right. services. So an actual better numbers to look at are the long-term facilities costs as well as the long-term waiver costs, because you will see a relatively rapid increase in the waiver cost versus the facilities cost.
Yeah. And I think Michelle has shared with us some way to normalize that by keeping track of the numbers of people anticipated as well as the budget, so you get kind of a unit cost as well. And I believe, Michelle, you sort of shared that chart. We could do that again if necessary.
Is it possible to get those enrollment numbers in?
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Right, Michelle?
Of course, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, let's proceed. I'm sorry. Representative Kemba has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Are the quality of service standards been developed?
Mr. Kemba?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the quality indicators are still under development. A number of the indicators have been determined, but we're still working on additional ones, such as the customer satisfaction process and so forth. So they're still under development. Some are done, some are not.
Mr. Chair, and who will evaluate these quality standards as we go around the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the quality standards will be some of the indicators will be numerical representations of what facilities are experiencing. The customer satisfaction piece that I referenced, which is still under development, right now is anticipated that would be a questionnaire that would be delivered to residents at their location.
Representative Kemba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In other words, will that be the surveyors that are currently in place doing that?
Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it would not be the Health Department surveyors.
Representative Tao, I think you had one.
My questions were asked.
Okay, thank you. Representative
Coleman? Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I understand this. Let's just look at fiscal year 2007. I think the base was 511 million dollars, and we're spending 1,360,000 less than had been anticipated. So actually, there's roughly a 2% cut in what we're going to spend on nursing homes in that year.
Well, you know, once and for all, because we could keep going on about what's called cuts and what's not. I mean, I guess it is true, as we said repeatedly, that these numbers show the change from what had been forecast. And I don't know about the actual, my sense was that we actually have a net increase from biennium to biennium in what we're spending, but it gets a little tricky because the occupation's changing at the same time.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner?
And Representative Huntley, I'm not sure about the math, but if you take 1% of $500 million is $5 million. So it would be more like 0.2% reduction.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. My mistake.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay, the second change page relates to home community-based waiver programs. The governor recommends the continuation of caseload growth management in three of the home and community-based waiver programs during fiscal years 06 and 07. The CADI program, or Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, would continue to expand by a maximum of 95 per month. The TBI, or Traumatic Brain Injury Waiver, would continue to grow by 150 persons per year. and the MRRC program or mental retardation and related conditions waiver would utilize 50 allocations to manage diversion growth for emergency purposes. As a reminder to the committee, the growth limits currently in place are scheduled to end 6:30:05. Additionally, a reference guide has been provided to you on waiver care options about the various programs that we administer under this program.
Mr. Coleman, you gave us on this caddy that was 95 per month, the TBI was 150 per year, the 50 for MRRC, is that a month or is that a year?
The 50 is total.
For the year or for the biennium?
For the biennium.
For the biennium, okay. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a waiting list on these currently, or how does that work? Do people get on a list for the waiver?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there are waiting lists. Particularly for the MRRC waiver, there is a formalized waiting list. There is approximately 3,600 individuals on that waiting list currently. On the CADI and TBI, that information is being compiled. That's not information that counties tracked previously, and we're in the process of working with counties to develop that. We have some estimates of people that are waiting for those services, but it's not formalized yet, and we'll be complete with that during the summer.
Mr. Chair, with regard to the MRRC waiver, I think it's important to understand that back in 1999, there was a waiting list of about 3,500 people. We had a process of open enrollment at that time that enrolled about 5,500 people in about a 60-day period. So we actually took care of the waiting list then and plus some. So there was, you know, that was taken care of at one point. Last year, when we did put the growth limits on these programs, the CADI and TBI growth limits were the same as what we have in place here under this proposal. We did add the 50 additional slots for emergency purposes for the MRRC waiver to deal with those situations where we felt we needed to address the waivered services right away. Keep in mind that the waivered services are in addition to, it's an optional program under medical assistance, and so all these individuals are currently receiving, or most of them should be receiving, medical assistance, the basic health care under the medical assistance program right now.
Please proceed.
That's it. Okay. Mr. Chairman, at this point, I'd like to bring Assistant Commissioner Brian Osberg down to talk about the health care area, I think. And while he's coming down, I have answers to two of the questions that were previously asked. All the funding sources for the agencies, including the special revenue funds, are included in the detailed fiscal pages in the background section of your book. So that information is in the background.
Good.
And then the finance website, late breaking news, the name or the address for that is www.finance.state.min.us. Kind of original.
Thank you.
Yep.
Mark from the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Health Care. I could turn you to page 22 of your packet. This relates to the Medicare Modernization Act, better known as the Medicare Drug Program. You wonder what the state has to do with the federal Medicare Drug Program. Well, there's two key issues here, two reasons why the state has to play a role in this program. One is that there's a legal requirement for states to provide assistance to Medicare beneficiaries in Minnesota, all 660,000, to help them sort this issue out. We know it's been very confusing for them, and so they're going to need assistance in two ways. One is to determine what level of eligibility they have, because low-income Medicare beneficiaries have better benefits. The second is to help them enroll into a health plan. They will be required to enroll into a private, either prescription drug program or a HMO-like program. unfortunately, the federal government did not give us any money to this. So we feel that we have to do this, and we think that not only is there a legal obligation, but perhaps a moral obligation to help these people in these figure out this this program. The second reason we have to be involved is that there's over 90,000 of our clients who are called dual eligibles. That means they're on both Medicare and Medicaid, or medical assistance as we call it. And what happens is Medicare is a primary payer, and then we wrap around, as medical assistance, we wrap around Medicare for long-term care services or anything that Medicare does not pay for. We've been doing that for many years. So it's in our interest to help these people certainly get into the right arrangement. Now, we're not sure. In fact, this starts January 1 of 06, where Medicare is the primary payer for our dual eligibles. Well, unfortunately, the federal government's going to take back the savings associated with that, most of it anyway. We have some forecasted savings. So Medicare, which is 100% federal, and medical assistance, which is 50% federal and 50% state, well, there would have been savings there, except they have a clawback provision, they call it, and they're gonna bring back to Washington most of the savings associated with this. That's unfortunate, but we have to deal with that issue. Now, most of the drugs that we cover through medical assistance probably will be covered through Medicare, but some drugs will not be, like over-the-counter drugs that we cover, and some mental health drugs. What we propose is that we're going to cover those drugs for our medical assistance recipients who are on Medicare. Now, the bigger question is, how about other drugs that that a health plan or a drug company is going to develop a formulary? We're not sure exactly what's going to be on that formulary at this point. We have to see what the market does. But let me direct you to page 23 is our proposal, specific proposal. First is that we need assistance and getting resources to provide help to the 660,000 Medicare beneficiaries. So we're asking for 3 FTEs to do that. We're also asking for other resources to allow our call centers and outreach sites to do their job. We're going to also ask for volunteers, there will be volunteers, to help us work with the Medicare beneficiaries to make sure they have the right plan available. Second is that currently we have a prescription drug program for low-income Medicare beneficiaries. We have 7,700 beneficiaries or clients in that arrangement. Now, they will have very good coverage under Medicare Part D. So we're proposing here that we eliminate our prescription drug program for that population, for 7,700. That's where the savings on this page really is coming from, is elimination of our prescription drug program. As I said, they'll have, under Medicare Part D, very similar benefits, so they will not be impacted by that. The third part of our proposal is to align our laws and arrangements with the new Medicare law. As I said, we're going to want to make sure we cover what's covered under medical assistance today, not covered under Medicare. We also don't want to eliminate medical assistance requirement to cover Medicare Part D drugs, because that's their obligation now. So we'll make it clear that it's no longer our obligation. Those are some of the highlights in this page in terms of our proposal. Now, we're also looking, look at the bottom of that page, we're also looking at maybe there's other ways in which we get more savings. You know, as I said, a lot of it's going to be returned back to Washington, so maybe there's other ways we can do this. So we're looking at whether or not we should include a general assistance medical care program for getting rebates. We're also looking at proposals of ability for us to get Medicaid level rebates, even though a lot of these drugs will be paid through Medicare. So we're in the process of examining those options, and we hope at some point to bring back to the legislature some possibilities as to how we can get other savings and to what extent we can wrap around further drug coverage for our dual eligibles.
And Mr. Chairman, we have to apologize for not being able to have those proposals worked out at this point. The Medicare Part D regs just came out a few weeks ago after we had to submit our budget documents to the governor's office and to the Department of Finance. And we're still going through those to see what the possibilities for potential savings are to the state. But we are continuing to work on that and look for areas where we can maximize the savings to the state with regard to this new federal law. One other thing that I wanted to emphasize, that if you look at the spreadsheet, there is an investment in money that will go out in aging grants to the Board on Aging and the AAAs. That money is to be sent out for this outreach and helping people as they access the Medicare Part D program. It does result in, and the assumption are that there will be a number of staff added at that level. They are not state staff, but they are staff of the Board of Aging and the AAAs. And, you know, we've struggled with this initiative internally because it is a federal program that we're asked to provide assistance for. And in one of my not-so-great moments, I was saying, well, what happens if we don't do it? And the reality is that we're not certain what the penalties are on the state, but we are pretty certain what will happen out there among the people that will be accessing and needing help on these programs as seniors. And that's that there's going to be a lot of confusion. They're going to be asked to make some decisions rather quickly with regard to the best choice of plans. And if they make the wrong choices, it can have a dramatic impact on their coverage and the cost of their coverage. And if they don't make the decisions right away, and there are penalties involved with what they have to pay as they move forward. So from our perspective, we think regardless of our frustration with the federal government not providing us the resources to fully be able to do this, we think it's important to provide the support for the seniors out there who will be accessing these programs and helping them make the appropriate decisions as this Medicare Part D option is coming forward.
On Strasburg, on the clawback, I mean, I can't necessarily blame federal government, which is still taxpayers, for if you get a net benefit in the state that you ought not to have a windfall. Do we have a sense, though, in Minnesota how well it'll balance? I mean, we've had it sort of stuck to us in the past at times when we've been one of the low-cost states and some of the federal formulas haven't been really fair to Minnesota. In this case, do we have a sense of whether it's going to be kind of a close to net zero?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, we are projecting a net gain. Now, I don't recall, I think Mr. Hoffman is not well today, so he's not here, so he has the numbers, but it's not significant. It's in the millions, a few millions, but not significant.
Mr. Osberg, it's not a loss.
It's not a loss.
Okay.
But we're also, now, they have not calculated yet the specifics, but that's our best guess based on what we know and based on what the regulations suggest.
Thank you. Any more questions? Please proceed.
On page 25, we're asking for more authority to buy drugs more effectively. You've given in the past that kind of authority to do multi-state purchasing, to allow us to provide for generic substitution when possible, to do at maximum allowable costs. But we need more at this point because 35% of our fee-for-service expenses associated with drugs. 35%, which is huge, bigger than anything else that any other service within our fee-for-service area. And so we need more authority. In fact, it's been said by the Office of Inspector General, the states need to do more. And the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Michael Levitt, suggested that they are going to focus on this issue as well. And so what we're asking for is the ability to go further in terms of managing these costs. And I'll quickly go through them. One is to allow us to do contracts, special contracts with specialty pharmacies for specialty drugs. We think that based on other states' experience, we can do better than we have today. We can get to the range of AWP minus 18 or 19 as compared to AWP minus 11.5 today. This is the experience of other states. So we're asking, these are kind of injectable drugs, special drugs that will not impact in terms of access. They're delivered anyway on a mail order basis. So just because we reduce the number of pharmacies involved, does that mean we'll reduce access to these drugs for our clients? So we think this is something that allows us to save some money. The second is a more specific drug is blood factor products for hemophiliacs. We can contract with what's called a 340B organization. Every university is such organization. 340B is a status from the federal government that allows, especially the hospitals primarily, but also some 340Bs are fairly qualified health clinics, allows them to purchase drugs more cheaply. And so what we want to do is be able to contract with a 340B organization in Mayo. It appears that we'll be able to have that status as well. I know some other hospitals are looking at getting that status. So this allows us to reduce our costs for very expensive blood factor products for hemophiliacs. The third is to set our...
Excuse me, yes. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Osberg, the 340B, I'm concerned about the hemophilia because I know we're going to have some testimony later, I presume, on this very matter. And does this mean that there'll be just the two places, Minnesota, Fairview and Mayo, that will supply the drugs for this group of people?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, all we need really was one. But we also, it's nice to have options, that way we can negotiate amongst them. But again, the 340 beef prices are kind of set already. So that's already, as I said, set by federal law in terms of the cost to them. And so we, in fact, that we can have these mail ordered to our clients, they are today, by and large, they're mail ordered to our clients today. So it's not going to impact the accessibility of these drugs for our clients.
Well, it's my understanding that there's a real problem in how fast they can get these drugs, and sometimes they need them right now, or they'll basically die if they don't get them. So I
think you're right, Representative Huntley. We'll
do it now,
more
but
about that.
There certainly will be some testimony on that later.
Yeah. Mr. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Weiber just mentioned to me that right now there's currently, based on the information that we've seen, 12 pharmacies that are selling these products to the people on our programs. So the net effect for that product would be from going from 12 to 2, if mail qualifies as a 340B. On the specialty products, the same applies. There's actually 10 of those 12 would be specialty pharmacies. So we're not talking about the entire universe of pharmacists engaging or selling these products right now. We're talking about a very small group of people that are pharmacies, a number of pharmacies that are actually engaged in the business of selling these products right now.
Well, I think as the discussion goes on, we probably want to know where those 10 or 12 are. And then I know in a few people that I've talked to, most of them are already getting it mail order as it was. So there'll be considerable discussion more. On the 340B, just maybe even just as a kind of a percent or something, kind of a sense of what kind of savings do we get out of going to 340B versus the current market?
Well, based on your tracking page, there's savings that we're looking at close to $1 million for 06 and 07, and over that for 08 and 09, about $1.2 million.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the next item has been on the middle of page 26, whereby we could purchase drugs that are administered through outpatient facilities, hospital facilities primarily. They're normally set to the Medicare rate, and the Medicare rate has changed. Up to this point, we've been paying AWP minus 5%, before that of AWP, period. But now Medicare, through that new Medicare Modernization Act, has allowed for changes to the reimbursement by Medicare. So what we want to do is mirror that change and provide for greater discounts on drugs administered through outpatient facilities. And the next item, Mr. Chairman, is the change in our reimbursement to pharmacies for drugs that we purchase. We don't purchase drugs directly from drug manufacturers. We purchase drugs through pharmacies. And so we tried to, and everybody else does, try to figure out what's the actual acquisition cost for these pharmacies and for these drugs. And it's always somewhat of a mystery as to AWP is average wholesale price. It's always been a mystery as to exactly what that is. But there's been analysis done as to approximately what the costs are. And for brand drugs, the best guess is that AWP minus 17 or 18%. For generics, it's AWP minus 60 or 70%. So what we want to do is two things. One is we want to line up and try to set up a reimbursement to reflect true costs plus a dispensing fee. We're not changing the dispensing fee here. It's $3.65. Number two is that we need to be in line with the marketplace. In essence, this is one area in which we pay more than the market. I'm not talking about the commercial market, like managed care organizations and insurance companies. We pay more than what the market pays. We can't say that about all of our provider services, of course, but here it is true. And we need to be in line with the market. This will also help us address more effectively the possibility of carving out our drug costs with a managed care company so we can take advantage of our Medicaid rebates. And that's something that the legislature directed us to look at 2 years ago, is the possibility of carving that out. But we have to be in line more with the market as to how much we pay for those drugs. So for those two reasons, that we think this is, reflects a true cost and a fair reimbursement bill, and number two, that it's aligned with the marketplace much more than it used to be, we think that this is an appropriate proposal to make at this point.
So just a kind of quick question on that regard. I believe we continue to have the provider tax. Most of our public assistance programs, we don't pay the provider tax. However, I think because of the way it's structured in pharmaceuticals, because it's, I think at the wholesale level,
right,
we still pay. Am I correct that we are paying, or that there is a collection of provider tax?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, that on the wholesale level, not on the retail level. But Mr. Chairman, we also consider that as we develop this number. We feel still AWP minus 14 is still, given that, because that's not true right in the private market, you're right. Even given that, we think that this is a rate that's comparable to the marketplace.
You proceed.
The last item on this budget page is the ability to prior authorize new drugs. Oftentimes what happens when a new drug comes online after FDA approves it, our drug formulary committee only meets every 4 months, and it takes a while before they get to all these things. So we're asking for authorization to be discreet about this, because sometimes a drug may come on that we should not, you know, make available to everyone because it's a miracle drug or something. So allow us to give the prior authorize these drugs for up to 6 months until a drug formulary committee can get to the issue and determine whether or not we should prior authorize it going forward. You've got to remember that prior authorization is our only real tool to manage our drug costs in terms of, because that ties to our rebates and everything else, because we don't have a true formulary like the managed care organization has or pharmacy benefit manager has. And so prior authorization is an important way of us to track and manage these costs. So we're asking for that authorization for up to 6 months after the drug has been introduced. And then by that time, the drug formulary committee will get to the issue and address whether or not. And we, you know, Nexium and Vioxx and Celebrex are some examples we probably would have needed and should have had that kind of authorization.
So, Mr. Osberg, absent that authorization, they would be automatically covered until the next cycle of the formulary committee.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Thank you.
And it's still covered, but we need some prior authorization to make sure that's appropriate.
Mr. Chair, we don't expect that we would exercise this if it's a new drug that's new on the market and has new impacts. But in this case, it would help us control a lot of the Me Too or the drugs that have a minor change in their formulation as they're and really do the same thing as a number of other medications out there, but they're being branded a different way and marketed a different way. And so it allows us to control those costs and make sure that we can address this right up front.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and either one of the two commissioners, how long does it take to get a prior authorization? I know we had testimony last year that in Michigan they can do it in 3 minutes. I mean, I'm concerned about the amount of time that the physician or physician's office has to spend on this.
Fair question. Welcome to me. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the pharmacy program manager for the department. It really depends on how the authorization comes in. It is in all cases within 24 hours, and that would be if the provider faxes the information in. If a provider calls in with the information, it is minutes. It is just a couple of minutes. We've also made a provision for evenings and weekends, and basically what we have told the pharmacies is that they, in those cases where they cannot get a hold of our prior authorization contractor, they can dispense up to a 3-day supply of the medication and be assured that we will pay for that 3-day supply even if the person ultimately doesn't meet the PA criteria.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, the next budget page is page 28. The proposal provides for a 5% reduction to the hospital rates. This does not include mental health services or Indian Health services. So the net impact is about 4.25% reduction. A couple of points I want to make. One is that under our current arrangement that we have for hospitals, we rebase periodically, meaning bring up the hospital rates up to the costs that the hospitals are incurring. The next time we're going to do that is January 07. We will look at the costs of the hospitals that they submit to us, and then we'll rebase the rates. And what will happen is that they'll catch up to full costs, not just the direct costs associated with providing services to our clients, but the full allocated costs. Now, the 5% would be off of that. That is true. But this is going to give the committee an idea of what's going to happen. We think, this is what's in the forecast anyway, for 2007, that the increase to the inpatient side for hospital rates will be 7.8% beginning January 107 for medical assistance and 17.1% for general assistance medical care inpatient rates. Now, this 5% reduction is for inpatient and outpatient both. The rebasing is only on the inpatient side, so I want to make that clear. But this is the only provider group in which we really set our rates based on their cost. And no other provider group has an arrangement like that. In essence, but again, the 5% would be, they're not going to make up the 5% because of the rebasing, but they're going to get an increase because of the rebasing arrangement, which is in current law.
So, Mr. Hogberg, the 2007 number that we have on our sheet then is sort of the net with the combination of the rebasing that was already in current law. So this is a saving off that rebasing. So there's probably then an actual net increase in rates, whatever the rebasing minus the 5%.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And remind me again, Mr. Osberg, what it was that around 2% net difference or something? Was that somewhere what you were saying? I thought you said the rebasing was going to go up about, well, 7% or GAMC was 17. Let's just take MA or whatever it was, the 7.8%.
Uh-huh. What would the net be? Because that's good we could calculate that because the 5% is on inpatient and outpatient. We can get that to you, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
It's a little more complicated, and I suppose it also depends on where in the biennium it actually occurs.
Right. That's a good question. We can get that certainly. The analysis as to what the net impact would be because the timing of the increase as opposed to the timing of the decrease. And
somewhat anticipating, Mr. Osberg, something that Chain Pay will get to, but the changes that are being planned for GAMC appear to offer an opportunity for hospitals, too, that might be a net better than where they were in, the current biennium. And so when we net these things, if we can combine that as well.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good point. The reinstatement of the GAMC spend down will have a net impact, a positive impact. On
Hotley?
Well, again, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Osberg, it looks to me like there's in fiscal year 07 there's $38 million less going to hospitals than we had originally forecast, and I assume that also means that there'll be a federal match that's lost as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, your latter point is true. The former point is the point that the chairman made as to what the increase is going to be, the net increase is going to be. What would have been before this cut is proposed? So we're going to provide information too as to what our projected increases are going to be the next 4 years for hospitals without this proposal.
But Mr. Osberg, to the question, to the extent that it's medical assistance, I think it is fair to say that that's federal dollars match that we lose as well.
Mr. Chairman, that's
to the
correct.
Extent that it's GAMC and others, then it's not because that's all state dollars.
That's correct.
Thank you. You proceed.
Mr. Chairman, the next page is page 29, and I'd like to have a handout here. To describe this page. This restructures our healthcare eligibility for our programs. Provides for three, as you see here, provides for three changes. One is that we reduce Minnesota Care eligibility for adult parents. parents and caretakers from 275% of the federal poverty guideline to 190% of the federal poverty guideline. 190%, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is $36,000 for a family of four. It varies by the family size as to what the federal poverty guideline is. But that's an example. It's $36,000 for a family of four. Now, the children of those families will continue to be covered up to 275%. We're not changing that. So between 190 and 275%, children will be covered, but adult parents or caretakers would not be. We're also not changing the pregnant women standard of 275% either. The next item is discontinuing Minnesota care eligibility for adults without children. General Assistance Medical Care Program provides for coverage for adults without children, so the proposal is that that coverage would not be available through Minnesota care. And the third, I'm going to go into some more detail in terms of numbers in a second here. And the third item is to restore the medical spend down provision for general assistance medical care. That is when an adult without children, without a child, is above the 75% income standard, which is $7,000 a year, and incurs expenses over a period of time down to that level. So to take the difference between their income and that $7,000, if they incur that expenses over a period of time, they're then eligible to enroll back in general assistance medical care. We had this program in place, but a few years ago it was, because of the financial situation we had, it was eliminated. So it's suggesting to reinstate the spend down, but eliminate the hospital-only arrangement, which really doesn't work out all that well for our clients or for the hospitals. Now let me take you through that that document that we just handed out. If you look on the enrollment change estimates, this is a two-sided document, enrollment change estimates, you will see the number of people in Minnesota care who will lose coverage or not be eligible for coverage going forward. This is our projection in out years as the number of people who will not be eligible because of these changes. But if you look down in the second graph, these are the number of people that will actually be eligible for some of our other programs, either medical assistance or general assistance medical care. So adults, we know we have a number of adults without children in Minnesota care eligible for general assistance medical care. We expect that 80% of them are going to move over. But actually, there's more eligible than this number we have here in this line. But there's always reasons why somebody will not do that. And so our best estimate based on the forecasting experts we have is that 80% of those eligible will actually move over to general assistance medical care. That the adults without children under 75% GMC line, 9,522. The next line is Minnesota care adults who will be eligible for medical assistance because they have a disability. What happens oftentimes is that those people who have a disability are enrolled in Minnesota care. It may not be known that they're eligible for medical assistance, and so they stay in Minnesota care. So in this case, they will have to move over to medical assistance if they have a disability and don't have coverage there. Then there's adults without children over 75%. I just described a spend down arrangement whereby people will spend down to 75%. This is a projection we have as to how many will be eligible for the reinstated spend down arrangement in Minnesota care. But then there's other people who are not in Minnesota care will be eligible for this spend down arrangement too. And this is the 1200 number is the number for that. So if you look at the net impact in the bottom page, and the reason that it's 19,000 for 2006 and goes up is because 2006, there's only 9 months that this is impacted because the change goes into effect October 1st. So if the change went into effect July 1, which we're not proposing at this point, which would be we don't think appropriate or possible, it would be a higher number. So the net impact really is, on an annualized basis, is 26 to 27,000 people. Now, if you look on the other side of this document, before the proposal, you see at the graph on top, before the proposal, we're projecting an 8% growth in our programs for the next 4 years. with the proposal, we still expect an increase of 4% in the next 4 years in our programs. Clearly, our programs are becoming a true safety net for people who don't have coverage in the private sector. And last time we met about our budget forecast, we talked about how enrollment has grown up, notwithstanding changes that took place 2 years ago. And it's just because more people are eligible for these programs. So you can see an increase in our program enrollment, notwithstanding these proposed cuts are cuts made 2 years ago.
Mr. Osborne, just to make very sure, and this probably isn't obvious, but because this is kind of a complex set of transactions that occur here, and maybe it's better to look at 2007 because, as you said, 2006 is only part of the year. So the net effect, and this is kind of combining, which I think we almost have to do these days, the healthcare access fund and general fund, is a net savings of about 53 plus million out of those transactions. Is that the net of this? Am I reading it correctly?
Mr. Chairman, should be $80 million. You just said
07. No, I'm sorry, just 07 I'm looking at.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're right.
I'll take 80. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you're right.
Any questions, members? Representative Huntley.
losing my voice here, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Commissioner Osberg, if we just look at 07, again, this, at the bottom of the first page, 26,788 people will be dropping off our rolls as opposed to what we had predicted under current law. So it'll be 26,788 people that won't have health insurance. And I just want to understand the spend down in GAMC. Isn't it true they have to spend down to about $580?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, no, it's spend down, well, yes, $500 a month. It's the same level. It's the 75% of FPG, so it's $7,000 a year, which is $500-some dollars a month. You're right.
Mr. Alford, just to make sure that members of the committee understand how that spend-down works, is if you went into a hospital, and I think we all know it wouldn't take much to be tens of thousands of dollars of expense, is it in that month that is played against the person's income to make them available, or is it some other mechanism?
Mr. Chairman, I have to defer to our staff, but I believe it would look back 6 months. Do they not?
And as they're coming up, we are talking about people who are relatively low income at the start even, so a few thousand dollars. I think it's important for the committee to understand how that spend down works.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm Roger Esmond from the Department of Human Services. The way the spend down works is it's a six-month income calculation where their income is estimated from the date of the month of application forward for 6 months. The level of income that exceeds the income standard for that 6 months, that's their spend-down amount. If they have medical bills incurred for any period prior, old unpaid medical bills incurred prior to that period, or in the month of application, they can apply that towards that spend-down amount. They will be responsible for that spend-down amount for those medical bills. Anything exceeding that spend-down amount would be paid by GEMC. And the eligibility and the payment begins the date of application forward.
I hope I kept that. I'll make sure that I did. No. Is anybody else caught up?
No.
That's lovely.
Well, let me give you an example. I received a phone call from a woman in Duluth about a week ago, and she is a lifelong diabetic, 46 years old, adult without kids on Minnesota Care, and she had a pancreatic transplant the end of December, which is working fine. She doesn't need insulin anymore, but she needs $3,000 a month in anti-rejection drugs. So obviously she's going to max out on the Minnesota Care, and now she's will be told, well, she can get on GAMC and spend down. She's a working person, relatively low income. Actually, she's a home health care aide. She'll have to spend down to, I believe, about $580 a month, and her mortgage is $500 a month. So how is she going to live on $80.
Well, here I just want to make sure we understood the mechanisms. I mean, she would be, but I think by those numbers, able to spend down to that level, it sounds like.
Mr. Chairman, just
Commissioner,
if you want to look at the spreadsheet on this, the we don't believe, and I don't believe that the spend down mechanism for GAMC will be an option that everybody will exercise who are will lose coverage under Minnesota Care. I think some people at relative higher income levels may find private insurance in the private market. I think it will depend on the individuals. There will be some people that I'm assuming will not take either option or will not be able to find private insurance or will do the spend down. But if you look at the spreadsheet, if you look at the costs associated with putting the spend down in place, you're looking at a net cost of $61 million for this first biennium. So this decision it's on page six, line 208. Page 6, line 208.
On the bright yellow.
Spreadsheet. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. So we can have a policy discussion about if the $60 million is spent appropriately on putting in a GAMC spend down. That was where we ended up with looking at all the consequences out there and providing a safety net for individuals. Or if it's better to be targeted towards increasing eligibility under Minnesota Care without the safety net in place. I think that's a legitimate policy decision and policy discussion to have. But where we ended up and where the governor ended up under her proposal was that we felt it was important to have the safety net in place, fully understanding there are people that will not exercise the option to take advantage of that spend down, but fully understanding that we assume there's going to be a number of people that will. And those people will be those that I assume will have chronic or very catastrophic type of conditions, and people that may or may not be very close to the income levels of 75% of poverty currently. If you look at the sheet that Mr. Assistant Commissioner Osberg went over, currently about 13,000 people that we're projecting will lose coverage in 2006 are adults already under 75% of poverty. And so that's just something to keep in mind. It is a policy discussion as to where government coverage and where the government should be involved in providing subsidized care should begin and where it should end. And this is our proposal based on the resources that we were given to work with as far as the budget goes.
Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Commissioner, have you looked at how many people are going to end up on MSHA because of these cuts?
Mr.
Chairman and Representative Huntley, that's a good point because you've made reference that there would be 26,788 people without health insurance coverage, and that's not necessarily the case because we are assuming, for example, the parents over 190% of poverty, family of four, the eligibility is going from $51,800 per year income to $35,800 per year income with the kids being covered. So we assume that there will be some people that will find options in the private sector. We assume other folks will access other options that are available to them, including MSHA. And so it's... you know, the numbers that we have here are only the calculations on our programs because these are the numbers we use to put our budget forward. So these are, we had to figure out or make estimates of the counteractions or where the people would move to get the net savings number that we came up with in our budget forecast. So what we're assuming here is just the impact on our current programs and our programs.
Commissioner, to the question about whether or not there's any MSHA net increase. Has anybody looked at that? Mr. Osberg, you know?
Mr. Chairman, no, we have not. The calculations have, because it doesn't impact our budget, so we have not looked at that specifically, but we can certainly try to get an assessment of what kind of possible change.
My intuition would tell me, MSHA is on the high side of as far as premiums are concerned, and these are relatively low-income folks, so I doubt that very many might.
Chairman, I agree with that. I think that's true. So even though they're subsidized rates, but
they're still over 100% of the market rate.
Yeah, they are.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, the woman I was referring to, obviously she's not going to be able to buy any insurance. No insurance company in the private market will
Representative Huntley,
I mean, so her only option would be MSHA, and she doesn't have the money to pay for that either.
Representative Huntley, you'll have, I'm sure, many, many examples. I don't think anybody's trying to portray the situation that there isn't an effect on people. There certainly is. We'll have a discussion about what would happen if you were in any other state practically in the union and compare, but just make sure that members understand what the proposal is, and we can debate later on.
Mr. Chair, as we've seen with a number of people that have come public with various issues related to health care eligibility, in a lot of cases they are eligible for other programs that we offer. And that I would ask, and if you do get contacts from constituents giving you their stories, especially if it seems to involve disabilities, that you have them contact their counties for assessment with regard to other programs they may be eligible for, example, medical assistance, disability coverage.
Representative Kemba.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I realize that some people aren't going to qualify for something, but in my world, there's still people. And there are people that won't be able to find any kind of insurance or pay for it. And those are people that we still have to deal with, whether we like it or not. I'm going to have a lot of farm families.
I'm going to have to cut off. I said let's not get into debate and examples and so forth. If you understand what it's doing, that's sufficient for today. You'll have your chance to debate it when we actually hear the bill.
Mr. Chair. I just wanted to for me to tell Commissioner Goodnow my feelings because he probably won't be here when we're debating it.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the mechanism, did I hear correctly that it's the point that the cost is incurred as opposed to the point when someone actually pays a medical bill?
Mr. Chairman, that's true. Expenses incurred during that period of time, that look-back period of time, 6 months, is what would calculate towards the person's eligibility determination.
Okay.
Thank you. Please proceed. Well, we are close on time. Where are we in terms of what additional is to be covered yet?
Mr. Chairman, the next budget page will take some time because it relates to the investment that we're asking for in terms of resources to better manage our health care program.
I think it might be wise for us then, because I've got a little bit of wrap-up to do here on minutes and so forth, if we defer that. And let me ask your best estimate. I'm thinking that we'll have maybe an hour tomorrow or something after we complete our bills. Would you expect that we might be able to complete this, or will we expect maybe we have to go into the evening?
Mr. Chairman, I think we get through my piece anyway for 15, 20 minutes.
Okay. Commissioner, do we have anything after?
Mr. Chairman, there's one other division or administration to hear from, and that's the chemical and mental health, and we have three initiatives there. I don't expect that would take more than 20 minutes.
Well, just and not all the members were here, so you're aware of what the plan is. The plan will be that we will continue with the Department of Human Services budget tomorrow after we hear three bills, which should be about an hour in. I think it's only fair to people who have bills to make sure we get those covered first. And then if we run out of time tomorrow, then we will continue the meeting tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Well, that's the plan for the committee. Well, thank you for today. Members, Thiessen moves, if you're okay with this, the minutes of our February 1st and February 3rd meetings.
I just had one question, actually.
Certainly.
It says here that we moved to include the crisis center, but we never took a vote on it, at least in the minutes. I'm not sure how that all fits together, but did all those amendments come together in that?
What date are we talking about?
First. I'm just assuming that was included in the...
It was,
okay.
Yes.
That's all I care. That I move that.
Well, we'll check on whether we need to, because it was adopted. Yes, yes. Any further questions or changes? Hearing none, ready to vote. All those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we will be tomorrow. I don't know. The news may be around, and I don't have too much more in detail, but one of ours... who's a very good friend of ours, and I think a lot of you know that Doug Maslow's son has been fighting for a long time, and he has passed away. So keep him in your thoughts. With that, we're